set of numbers.
Conference record has joined the conference.
Okay. Now what am I doing? I'm not even going to press the flash button. This thing here. Okay. Hello? Hello?
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted.
I think because they keep on saying hello, hello, you know, so I think let's try to unmute it. Did they cut it?
The leader has turned lecture on, and your line will remain muted until the conference leader unmutes your line. To start or join your conference, press 1. To change default conference options, press 2.
Through a brief review of the dual eligible question, then we'll...
To start or join your conference, press 1. After joining the call, to record the conference for those who may miss this call, or for future playback, press star 2. You will now be placed into conference. To mute your line, press star 6. To unmute, press pound 6.
You want it to work?
Okay, we're beginning. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to
go over. I'm going to be fairly quick on the slides.
That's the bind down. I have no idea.
Class C was requested for a little bit more information. This is a little bit more on what the duals are, where the spend is. So the first slide is a graph of expenditures and dual eligible population.
Oh, right.
Yes.
As you can see, from 2003 to 2010, we've gone from roughly 600 million people to over 700 730,000 people to 600. The number of eligibles have gone up, as well as the expenditures. 2003, we're at about 15.5 or so. We're up to about 18.4 or so. The dip on the expenditures between 2005 and 2006. 2006 was the Part D on the Medicare side. So those are those previous pharmacy was previously covered by Medicaid. It's not by Medicare.
But it didn't last long.
Didn't last long, no. Next slide. I'm not sure who's doing the slide. This is just a quick breakdown of one question. Where's the money going? Is it the disabled or the elderly? This is breaking down by age. Roughly $11 billion of the $18.6 billion is spent on persons over 65. Which is about 59% of the money, and of the people, it's about 400,000 people, which is constitutes about 68%. So fairly close distribution of people and money. The next three slides are really where the services, where the money is going, what we're paying for in Medicaid. So this is the combined view, and you'll see a different picture in a second. Nursing homes at $4.9 billion. Labor services at 4.1, personal care at 1.7, OPWDD residential services at 2.1, jobs at 1.2, managed long-term care, it's managed long-term care, at 1.3, inpatient for 63, et cetera. The next slide really breaks it down. How do I explain waiver services?
OPWDD OMR has a pretty extensive waiver program, and it could be residential services, day-have services. So it's really a package of services, person-centered around, you know, that's developed around the person. And they've grown that program over the years very significantly as they institutionalized this population. And converted ICF, they used to have this term, you know, ICF have been converted into, which would be 16 plus beds, now been downsized to like 4 plus beds in a home. So it's basically. Mental health.
Long-term home health care program,
yeah.
Too, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it's for the mental retardation population.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if we go to the next slide, we look for the picture changes. The next slide will be for persons over 65. And affected, most of the services for over 65 are long-term care services, such as nursing home at 4.4, and labor service, much reduced, personal care at 1.1, child services at 1.6. So when I look at this, it's about 74% of the services we provide for persons over 65 are what I would call long-term care services, both institutional and
in the managed care, what does it say, including FHP, what do they put in? Okay.
It should just stand as long.
And both slides are just the one?
All the slides. So the majority of the spend for over 65, as expected, 74% is on what I would call long-term care services, both plan services, job, personal care, and nursing homes. The last slide in this group is for under 65. It's a different picture. And waiver services for the OPWDD population 3.4, OPWDD residential 9. That contributes about 70% of the dollars here. So it's really different programs. We know that once the elderly wants to be disabled, but this kind of tells us a picture of where the money's going. There would be a lot of long term care service for over 65 and waiver or MARTEC services for them. That's a quick snapshot.
In that under 65 category, there are OPWDP services that are dominating a lot of that, but then there's other populations that are in that pie chart, right?
That's correct.
Other disabilities.
Other disabilities, right. Correct. So are there any questions on this? I'm trying to move along because we have so many other things I want to get to.
You know, maybe we should talk, though, for a minute. It's very hard to hear down here, so I don't know if it's hard to hear there, but I'm going to yell. We should probably mention, too, that last Friday Pat, John, Jason Helgerson, Jim and Chona had the opportunity to meet with Melanie Bella, from ACS, leading the school. And I think that meeting gave us a little bit more clarity on their thinking. And so by October 1st, states, including states like New York that have $1 million planning grant for the dual under the ACA, need to submit a letter of intent to HHS on the dual. There's a state Medicaid directive letter laid out two options to state. The first option is interest in a three-way agreement for the dual. The three parties are the federal government, the state government, and an intermediary, either a health plan, a healthcare delivery system, and it's a risk model. For some folks who might remember the pre-Medicare Advantage days, those arrangements look like the Massachusetts waiver or the Minnesota waiver that was in place for dual. So there was an integrated model that did not include a Medicare Advantage plan. The hope in that model is that some of the administrative difficulties in coordinating Medicare and Medicaid side of the house are resolved, but there's one set of operating rules. So that's one option that they have. The other option that they have the opportunity to explore, HHS calls a managed fee-for-service model with shared savings with HHS. So the Department of Health, you know, current thinking is that on October 1st or by October 1st, they will submit a letter basically stating their interest in one model or both. It's really to get it on the record. As one of the next step, it will have, I think, unless John has more current information, very little detail in that other than to make sure we have our hat in the table.
So you've already written your letter, right? Because October 1st is in.
No, I don't know the letter.
I mean, I don't mean that meanly, but like you guys already have, must have already made the decision.
Well, there's not much of a decision here in my view, Elizabeth. The decision is whether or not as a state you express interest in further exploring.
Oh, you don't have to pick one of the two options?
Okay.
And that was, I think many states are going to probably express both.
And where would you ask them?
Why not? I mean, why not? Particularly if you have areas of the state that are more rural and you may not immediately be able to use the capitated models. The first model, the three-way agreement, is a capitated arrangement where Medicare and Medicaid payment flow to a capitated entity. So, again, the Massachusetts GO is a good example, actually, of that program.
And you don't have to be an entity that has already approved Medicare in a Medicare Advantage?
It looks like HHS will defer to whatever the state decides about the qualifications of that entity.
Okay.
Within certain points. But I think from the meeting that we had, what I left kind of hopeful about is that it might offer an opportunity to kind of resolve this longstanding question about administrative rules for Medicare and Medicaid. Not lining up. I mean, more to come, obviously, but I wanted you to all be aware that we've had that discussion and that the week of 50 years as a committee on the topic setting a letter.
What's the next deadline after October 1? You have to be clear on that one.
I don't know if they've given us another deadline. Do you recall, John, a deadline?
No, I did not hear another deadline other than a letter of intent, so there's a lot that we can shape. And then actually when we get into the potential recommendations, you know, we'd like to hear this group do on how we shape that. And we'd like that to be the major recommendations that come out of it.
So is your current thinking to submit a letter of intent to explore both models in New York?
Just to let them know that we're interested in exploring. That's what Melanie said. It can be as simple as just a letter saying, we're interested. She was very encouraged, I thought, you know, what we had to say and offer as a state.
I think it's incredibly important to be grateful, so we just say that up front, but it's a gigantic amount of medical money for the dual, $25 billion. I don't know what it is. It's a huge amount of money. So is there any information? I mean, there's a lot of understand about your vision, CMS's vision, just under the three-way contract, does Medicare
turn over all of the Medicare AD money to the state under its own rules, kind of figures out a different way to pay it to the system?
I think that would be a variation, which we'll want to talk about in terms of how we could approach, you know, CMS. Instead of a three-way agreement, there could be a situation where the state, in essence, goes at risk, gets the capitated payment, and that we then, in turn, decide to subcapitate that.
I don't know inherent. I don't know that inherent in a three-way agreement is the state taking risk for Medicare. I mean, many of those demos operated in the past without the state taking on any risk for Medicare, but it was similar to Medicare, or Medicaid Advantage Plus. Product where one entity receives two streams of revenue, Medicare and Medicaid, by a comprehensive package of covered services. But there's a lot more details that we need to talk about. If you like very much, once we get past this October 1st letter of intent, I think they'll be able to, HHS will be able to focus more on specific state grants, and we'd like, we'll have more discussion, and hopefully more from HHS.
But a lot of those duals are in fee-for-service Medicare. They're not Medicare Advantage, right?
And so the second option is actually a managed fee-for-service model.
Right.
And do Medicare payment still apply? You know, whether it's on the physician side and hospital side, or is that just a state using that? I don't know that we can find out those details, but I think in the demos that existed prior to this, that the state did not take risk for Medicare and that the Medicare payment rules apply. What I think the demo did do was line up things like marketing for Medicare and Medicaid, the appeals rights for Medicare and Medicaid. So there's a lot more to know. I just wanted, while we're having this discussion and we need to have more of a discussion about the duals, I just wanted everyone to be aware that this is October 1st date coming up, and our intention is to make sure we've reserved our spot at this date.
Can I just ask, this sounds like a retrograde question, but this is a distinct population from what we were talking about in California, right?
Distinct in which, I mean, there's overlap between the populations. Significant overlap.
Okay, that was what I was trying to understand. So some of these patients may be dealt with under the health program.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. I mean, I think, and they're coincidentally about, you know, they number there's 700,000, our estimate, there's 700,000 duals. That was the two intersecting pie charts we put up last time, right? And there's roughly 700,000 to 800,000 health home, you know, people that we've targeted and just, you know, provided data on. We think there's tremendous overlap between them. So to the extent that we're developing health home structure, right, to better manage care, we think it positions us to either go at risk or do shared savings model. It's the next step.
Right. It's the payment design reform that underlies and supports the health home model going forward.
It does get confusing now when you think of the health home population, this new waiver for experiment. And what exists now, and, you know, could you be in more than one at a time, for example? Could you see the health home as a component of the agreement with them?
Yeah.
And is this population, I assume that this is part of the population that the mandatory enrollment for the home and community-based care piece of services. I mean, how does that kind of fit into, how does that policy imperative fit in with health homes and kind of the bigger plan?
I'm not sure if I followed.
Well, you have a policy that as of April 1,
right,
all of those receiving home and community-based services for more than 120 days, which is a lot of this population, will be mandatory enrolled in either an MLTC or care coordination model.
That's right.
So I'm trying to keep kind of the pieces in my head.
I think it's very easy. You know, in our mind, you can be in a health home and be in fee-for-service or be in managed care. And when we went through the slides Greg went through last time, he laid out the overlap between people that are target population for health home and how many of those are currently in managed care.
again, HealthHome is a care coordination system,
yeah.
Right? Managed care is a financing system,
yeah.
Right?
It's like, you know, the HealthHome is the frosting on the cake, mm-hmm. You know, and the waiver and the payment is the actual cake part, sort of underneath, and that you got to, well, you know, I think part of the mandate of this group is to work on the cake part. Over time to make sure that it sustains changes that we're trying to make in the payment system that reinforce the goals that we want to see with health plans or something like that. So the way this kind of duals program would be about trying to change what's going on with the cake. To take that farther.
I want a sweet cake. anything you want to keep going? Principles. There's a set of
it was attached to your PowerPoint. There's a separate page with principles.
We initially had these rest on, but we didn't spend a lot of time on, right?
Correct.
Has anything altered?
Just the change that we've got from Kathy this morning.
Okay.
That's why we have a separate page. We got it with last chapter.
Actually, I wanted to add a concept to this. I think, I'm not sure, maybe it's implicit in some, or some people can see it there, but more explicitly say that a goal of the reform should be fragmentation in the system, and particularly payment fragmentation in care.
So something like reduce payment fragmentation to allow for better care management or something along? Something like that? Or
I don't know. I would say it's just to reduce fragmentation and care. Payment systems, particularly those that need fragmentation and care. Another way to say it is to reduce fragmentation payment systems with the goal towards ultimately aligning systems towards the population.
Okay.
I don't want to say that.
Yep.
Fragmentation. Jim, I'm sorry. Jim? I'm going to frame this as a principle. I want to back us up just 5 minutes. Because we actually used the metaphor to describe the program, so we were doing cake and frosting. And my whole life of Medicaid being a Cadillac, no, it's not a Cadillac, it's a healthcare program. And we ought to recognize that as we are going to metaphors, to try to describe the interrelationships of the programs that we are creating and are working on, we've got to just come back to each other and keep saying we've actually got to keep explaining how these things work together. And we're dealing, all of us, thoughtful people, experienced people, with interrelating 3 or 4 or 5 new concepts. And in a sense, God forbid when that all descends on one patient. There's a challenge here of continuing to work to advance the explanation of how the various flows of money and care responsibility work. And I don't know how to articulate that, but I'm just always struck whenever I go to a metaphor, it means that I can't quite figure out how to explain it in the program. So, I mean, I think that's in the spirit of this, explaining this to the literati is really going to be essential to anybody out on the receiving end of this thing to figure out what the devil with these people will do.
Is there some sense
in
patient center? The patient is at the middle of it.
Well, it is, except I don't want to just assume that I'm always, I guess I'm saying I've got somebody helping with coordination, and I got a couple of different payment streams that are in here. And so I'm looking, I don't know, Pat, if I'm a plan, I've got some of these people being helped this way and some of these people helped this way, but I have a contract that says that. I mean, it's kind of just making all the streams fit together and understanding the qualitative difference between the strategies, and I just want to keep hammering away at getting to the understanding of how the strategies fit together.
Okay.
In the principles, we're repeating the words providers and payers multiple times, and yet we use the word patient once and in a very narrow concept, in a very narrow sentence. So I think the lead should really be related to patients, and I don't see any language about access to care for patients.
Not everybody is a patient. I mean,
yes, they
client
patients. And then apropos of that, and the whole discussion we had earlier, the bullet on the safety net is very institutionally focused, reinforce health systems clinic, and preserve Medicaid safety net providers' care, as opposed to something like preserving community services or something that's more focused on the population and the people, which I think was an important discussion that we had earlier.
Oh, wait, which one should we be working off of, the old one or the...
Which one?
There's a loose one and a...
She said to get the loose one out, but now it seems like Marlene's working off of...
I was working off of that in the packet that followed the discussion before.
So is that the new one and we should throw out this old single one?
No,
no.
Just to again clarify, the one that we just put up was the add-on. There was a variation. Remember, we had the discussion: were we comfortable with the word standard of care or evidence-based?
Right.
I said, could you rewrite it to convey what we thought the conversation?
Right.
So that's just a rewrite.
I guess my question is a little different, is that we have several pages of general guiding principles, right? We have page 1, 2, and then page 24. Page 24 is not something.
That's correct.
Right, that's
and then there's some more on 25.
Yeah.
We have a lot of guiding principles. We have four pages of guiding principles, right?
Hmm.
And one, presumably there's four buckets for our guiding principles, right? And that's why we have four pages.
No, what happens is the pages 1 and 2, the standalone page that you have, should be substituted for the page in your packet. We just
for page 25.
For page 25.
Correct, because we've got it so late.
But not page 24.
Page 24 is still in place.
24 stands,
okay.
And 1 and 2 replace
24.
Okay.
Gotcha.
24 stands.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Okay.
I understand what you're saying now, Marlene.
Yeah.
Sorry, because I was looking. I was like, where is she?
Then 25 is replaced by 1 and 2?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Should I ask Marlene to do her edits on 24 again?
Please.
Yeah.
Really? All right. I think that almost as a guiding principle, which I guess you get it now in page 1 of 2, I don't know. We talked about populations, patients, access to care. I think we need to put this in that kind of language. It's too much on provider payer. The word provider and payer is repeated multiple times. The word patient appears once. In the bullet on Medicaid safety net, it's very institutionally functioning focused, and our whole discussion was the geography, the population, the people's needs. I think it needs to be refocused that way.
Can I say something, which is that it seems to me that each, we have three pages, three buckets, I think, but we don't, all the buckets titles say the same thing, quality measures in the Medicaid program, payment and quality initiatives, and like the titles are all the same. Is there something that distinguishes the three buckets? Like is one bucket supposed to be about one thing and another bucket supposed to be another? It just, the organization that's just driving me crazy.
Well, I think when we initially started this, we tried to have a set of principles that were more on the patient orientation and then another set that were quality. Right? So that's how we approached it, the innovative payment models and quality should.
Yeah.
On the first page, those are primarily payment-related. Then on the new pages 1 and 2 are quality.
Quality, right.
Thank you,
Tom. So should we go through that?
Okay.
But that was our approach. It was a joint effort with us and Amy's folks. But
you might want to change the headings to reflect that. So general guiding principles for.
We could have general guiding principles, maybe what?
Payment models.
Payment models.
Yeah. And then general guiding principles for quality initiatives and whatever we say.
Okay.
And access is usually considered part of quality. I don't think it is in the way you're doing it.
Yeah, that's fine. I think
I don't know.
But we tried, and we can put access in.
I don't
or
feel like
we have
access is even allowed to be part of our charge. I mean, I wish it was, but they just don't think access is part of our charge.
Doesn't seem to be. I mean, I wish it were, but I'm not. I'm just saying it doesn't.
Oh, I think it is. That's why we're doing care coordination to make sure people have access to the right kind of care. Otherwise, they get the wrong kind of care and they overspend. That was
well,
the whole point.
On safety net is
yeah.
Right, is that true, John? I mean,
yeah, I think it's fair.
They don't get access to primary care, yeah. Then what's the point of that whole discussion we have?
Sure.
I would say that we're this innovative planning.
So,
I thought the whole point of that was to get a 90% match. I mean, that's what everybody kept saying.
No, that was,
you know, I mean, like, what are we getting here?
I mean, should we go through these one by one? I'm just trying to think of a rational way. And certainly to the point that at least, you know, that wherever we say providers and payers, we ought to say whatever we call them, clients, patients, whatever. But if we're going to be transparent, that means the public as well as providers and payers.
But who is the primary audience for these guiding principles?
I think it's us.
To develop the recommendation.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's the principles that we sort of are the screen for the recommendation.
Okay.
It's criteria for it.
Right.
But
where are we going next?
If you're trying to create a payment reform system, that's going to save money. But if you do one that's going to save money without these principles, which have to include access and have to include quality, then you haven't really bought anything that's worth anything. You just save money by lowering quality and lowering access, which I think... it's the reason why I'm saying those words are very important in your film.
Well,
I
totally agree with Rita.
Yeah. And anything about engagement. You know, when you talk about transparency, you know that you also need to focus on the engagement of the patient to cooperate with the partner.
I think the engagement is that is very confusing to the provider. You know, it's got to be very confusing to the client.
I mean, I think this is sort of like another transition issue, you know, that, the movement nationally certainly is towards patient-centered measures of values. In other words, something about the patient experience. I don't think necessarily that can happen now because we don't have the measures, and that's a work in progress that may take some time. But I think it's something, again, to sort of stress. And at the end of the day, it's really what is the patient or client's experience in this system, and that has to have value. But I think we have to transition to that. I don't think we're there yet. We don't have any way to measure. We don't have many ways to measure.
That's right.
So can we just add a sub-bullet on page 2 that says promote access to care? I mean, can we just get...
Yep.
I mean, let's...
Said that should be first.
Yeah, or you somewhere, but I just...
Yeah, I think it should be first.
I agree.
Love them both, yeah.
Okay. But I think if we're talking about it as a header, it should also have a sub-bullet that actually talks about
yeah.
it.
Well, one is it's a principle, and two is we could say that that's a measure that we want. I mean, we can do it in two ways. So it would be in the first, it would be on 24, which is the overriding, right? And then we can sort of repeat it on page 1, I think, that quality measures that promote access or whatever. I mean, that we're measuring whether people have.
And I think we want them to have the access. I think what everyone's been saying is we want them to have access to the right care.
Right.
But I also think we should have payment policies that promote access.
Yes.
I argue, as you guys
yeah.
know, that our DISH payment policies do not promote access at all, essentially.
Okay, so we have access highlighting under principles, and we have this leading to patient-centered measures, so the development of patient-centered measures that we expose to, it will reveal the experience of patients.
On bullet 6, where it talks about getting everybody to manage care management 3 years, is that too different? Now, I don't know that we know that we have
or maybe we faster, longer. I'm not sure why we're picking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're trying to learn whether we got a demonstration here, whether it even works.
That's what it's there because it was part of the big MRT. Whether you want to, take issue with it or modify it,
I think you want to
discuss that. But
demonstrate or find out whether, in fact, this strategy is effective in providing cost-effective care for patients.
I thought that was sort of a given, that this is sort of the state saying we're out of the risk business. Now,
do you interpret this as managed care as opposed to care management?
Care management, broadly. That, right.
Right, and I don't know that we know that necessarily is for every patient fits into that category. It might be only that 5% of the patients or 20% of the patients.
Sure. I just took this as the state has basically said, we're getting out of the risk business. Good luck, health plans and providers, and now it's yours.
But managed care, that's not care management.
Yeah. And
I'm flipping to the risk is someplace else.
The risk is someplace else, right. It doesn't have to be in health plans.
This implies to me kind of more the whole home, that you're going to manage these patients.
I think it would be really helpful to bucket these things. We have a set of recommendations around health homes, ACOs, whatever, that all care coordination stuff. And then we have a bucket of stuff we're working on that's like DISH and the safety net that I feel are sort of like a different bucket. And wouldn't it be more helpful to have our principles organized by what we're actually talking about?
I think this one works in a sense that it's well, to the quality. It's in that kind of. I mean, the access is what I think. To me, it's the access, and the payment is going to be needed to follow to make these things happen. I always think that we got to think about how we want to take care of patients. What's the model of care? What's the efficient and cost-effective model of care? And then we'll figure out later on how you pay for that. We'll figure out how to pay for those things. I don't think we know the models yet. I think that's what we're trying to figure out.
Would jumping to the recommendations help us crystallize these guiding principles? I really do think we've got a bat, and again, you can part my statement is to move the conversation along. Look, I think that based on the conversation over the last 3 hours, I think we're all in the same ballpark as to the kind of bellwethers we want to accomplish. And I think that if we look at the recommendations, we agree on the recommendations, and then flip back to the principle, I think they're just going to fall.
But the only point that I would like to pick up on that's being made here is that there should be a guiding principle around a design for learning, because we don't know what works. And if we don't have a structured system in place to capture learnings along the way, shame on us for a missed opportunity. So I think that if I can take liberty with what you're suggesting, I think that there needs to be a design principle around a framework for learning what's working, what's effective.
Yeah, and that actually models on what's happened in the national discussion, both the work of IOM, and there'll actually be an IOM report on learning healthcare system next year or something.
I think, though, there is something that does make these a little confusing, though. I'm not suggesting the bucketing, and maybe we could deal with it later, but I think that there are sort of implied principles in some of the ways these are detailed out, so particularly on the quality. So I guess we want to be encouraging certain behaviors among clinicians, or we want people to work together, or something. There's something general happening here, but you're getting very specific. These are almost outcomes that you want as opposed to principles. So if you're going to have a statement that says something like, we should risk adjust because we don't want to penalize people for what they're not responsible for, that suggests that we want people to be accountable for what they are responsible for, but we don't say that. So these are almost like sort of the nuances of some sort of hidden principle that we all know we have, but we haven't stated them. And it might be useful for others who look at this to hear them, even though it's maybe not something we have time to do today. But you know what I'm saying? Like, these are almost like the amendments to the principle on some level. Like, you've got to have, you got, maybe it's the triple aim. I don't know. Maybe you have, like, some big picture principle up there that you want to get, you want to improve quality, you want to increase, you want to lower cost, you want to improve access, which is part of quality. Is that it? But I think you need to get a little bigger picture on this. That's why I mentioned the patient. And you talk about the safety net, but obviously there's something behind that. You want to preserve community stability. What is it?
And
I'm sorry. Of the triple aim, which is not reflected, and we haven't talked about it, so I don't want to complicate things as improving the patient's experience in care. Or in my case, I run a very large Medicare Advantage plan, and I got to tell you, all the CMS keeps doing is on member satisfaction, which in downstate New York is very, very challenging for the population. Nevertheless, if you go to hear Dr. Berwick or anybody from CMS these days, you know, the patient experience of care from their perspective is going to become a larger and larger part of what they're looking for from the healthcare system. You know, I don't want to throw a wrench into a but not to mention it as a goal of our, you know, I mean, the patient can have a lot of different patients.
So that's in the triple A, right? I mean, let me just read from this. Is, this is from something from Fisher and Gene Nelson up at Dartmouth, and this is in a different context, but it's just a nice way. So the way they express the triple aim is a better care experience, better health, and lower cost per capita.
Which very simple. If we go to the recommendations,
I'm just saying that might be your lead.
It might be the lead harmony principle. I would just like to urge us, you know, to frame things where activities are happening at the national level.
Yeah.
Whatever we frame, as long as we agree with it, should really reflect that. Because, you know, it just adds power to whatever we're doing.
Well, should we go to the, are you guys okay? Let's go with Rick. So we have we developed, you know, a series of potential recommendations that they underline, you know, the word potentially. It's more or less, I think Rhonda had suggested at the conclusion of the last meeting, you know, we need a little more direction here. This was our attempt to get the discussions going. For better or worse, they're on the page to be critiqued, right? So I'll just say that right now. So the first one, right, and Donna touched on this, is, you know, stemming from the conversation that we, you know, had with CMS last week, pursue a partnership agreement with CMS to integrate Medicaid and Medicare programs and financing for the dual eligible population under a capitation approach, right? So that recommends.
I agree. Why you limit to capitation and not to some other model.
Yeah, and we can have
which
that.
Which is actually the other model that you talked about in the submission.
Yeah, we can have that, you know, discussion, but let me just go through this and then. So what are the goals, right? The first one right there is the triple A, right? And I think for all the reasons Mr. Levin just articulated, it makes complete sense for us to force them where CMS wants us to go, and that should be, you know, part of whatever this waiver proposal would be. The second, create opportunities for providers, payers to realize financial benefit as system efficiencies are achieved and quality benchmarks are attained. Right? It's just in line with our previous conversations that we just had about keeping dollars in the community. I think another element of this is that if we were to go, right, with the full risk, which is, say, the state going at risk for the Medicare duals, which is a large portion of the Medicare program, perhaps there's a way for us to shield ourselves from the cuts that we talked about last week that are coming down the pike at the healthcare system. So this would be us basically stepping forward, CMS, OMB, saying, you know, we understand the Medicare program has to achieve savings. We don't want to do it with incremental cuts to the end. We'd rather take our cut right up front and go with a capitated approach and share that risk downstream with providers and payers. But that's secure upfront investment of resources from CMS, which were required to implement our waiver program. Such funds need to be flexible, could be used for continued funding of care management beyond the two-year incentive period, HIP, ACO development.
So we've been hearing that as part of the discussion, like what happens at the end of the 2 years. Well, maybe we want to lock in and make sure that 90% or some portion thereof keeps flowing.
Is that just for the duals?
This would be part of, yes, but there's a big overlap between the duals and the health home population.
We might want this for more than
that. We may want it for more than that.
I would think we would.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Mr. Sisto's approach about this should be, you know, California-like, meaning it should be broader and encompass more fixes than just the duals, right? We can use this as an avenue to, you know, take care of a number of our collection problems here. And then we're inviting people to, you know, are there other potential needs? These are ones that we just, you know, jotted down. At our last meeting, Dr. Safdier said there's no money for ACO development, not part of the $10 billion allocation. Perhaps this is an opportunity for us to have for some ACO development.
So I just wanted to, does this also include the transition? I mean, the thing we talked about much earlier, that actually delivering better care may cost more money up front. You know, we have a promise maybe of savings down the road, but we want to do better by people, improve the experience. That's not cost neutral. So would that, I mean, would that be included in this?
I think as part of this, you know, we would ask California got somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion,
yeah,
something along those lines. I don't think we would be bashful to ask something that's
so, but I think we should be specific in articulating that here, that we recognize that delivering better care, at least initially, will probably cost more money, and we need that transition money.
So I think, you know, I appreciate your expression of the vision, John, which is, you know, pretty clear. I think this is a bit specific for this group to adopt as a specific recommendation in terms of, you know, the whole capitation approach. And the vision is good, and I think, as you described, actually filing LOI, a lot of people will need, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys, who really want to understand more about the details of that vision, because it's, what you're describing is kind of gigantic. So I'd be more in favor if we have, if this is our next to the last meeting, to come out with a recommendation that is something more along the lines of what John has described as kind of getting in line, to pursue options with CMS that would promote the integration of Medicaid and Medicare services and financing for the dual-eligible population, remove current barriers to integration, and promote better outcomes and experience of care for our population. I would be more comfortable staying that inside of that box. You know, the capitation approach seems like the ultimate bit. It's kind of big, in my view, to ask this group based on what we, or little that we know about this, which is, I guess, like that approach. I mean, it could include that, but I...
What?
I agree.
No, I mean, I'll concur. My thoughts are just to strike the last four words, principle. Strike those last four words.
I think, the advantage, of course, in capitation is you're locking in a base, right? You generate savings, hopefully, because you're locked in a base. Somebody requires rebasing down the road, it's green again. But theoretically, on the other hand, I do like the idea, at least on the front end, of saying that's kind of the preferred direction up front and also a long-term priority, but we don't want to lock people out either from the...
You're not precluding.
Not precluding.
Right.
Yeah, you could lock in a base, though, in a global payment system or a episodic or a, I mean.
Am I confused? I thought the capitation in this context was referring to the funds that would flow from the federal government to the state.
That's right.
Is
that
the context?
And that is the context. Okay.
And then underneath that, we could apply everything that's just been discussed.
Now, I thought I heard before, though, that you weren't sure that you wanted to
see it. Well, obviously, it's a very big decision for us, right? And it will hinge upon a lot of the stuff that we're talking about around the table and putting systems in place where we think that, you know, cost can be controlled. The state's going to go at risk, right? That's a big deal and a lot of money, right? So, and there will have to be some shared risk arrangement down stream, right? But the other side of it is, you know, do we step up now and try to take some control back from the federal government on some of these big Medicare cuts?
Okay. Okay, so yeah, given that context, does that give people a different perspective?
But the idea of putting the capitation component here, is that related to the waiver, the opportunity to get that waiver? Are those two integrated?
Yeah. Yeah.
So are you saying that in order for us to have a shot at getting the waiver, we need to talk about capitation at this level, at the state and federal level?
So there's
two levels here, right? There's a financial arrangement between the state and the federal government, which could be none. I mean, currently there's no financial arrangement for Medicare between the state and the federal government. The other layer is the arrangement between the state and the delivery system. Right now we have one arrangement, which is with the managed long-term care plans that do the Medicaid Advantage product. And that's a capitated arrangement. After that, the state has no financial arrangement with any provider to provide Medicare services. I think it's confusing because there's two levels. I think what this was drafted to intend, was intended to mean was the relationship between the federal government and the state. Underneath that, I think the state could have varying arrangements with providers of service or managed care. It could be some mix in some areas of the state. There'd be a relationship with capitated as it currently is, between the state and a health plan, or it could be a managed service arrangement between the state and a healthcare provider. So I don't think we want to limit.
Why don't we just put a period after the population for now? And because I think that's tripping people up, and people who aren't here will be tripped up by it, and then go on to the next.
Yeah, I mean, is there any downside to in that?
Except
this is there's a requirement to get.
No, but it said for financing. I mean, it's with the.
I'm just not. It doesn't preclude it.
Doesn't
I think
preclude.
One of the issues is leaving the flexibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can leave it out, it doesn't preclude that it goes that way.
Right.
And I think you're going to have to see how the negotiations go. But there may be providers that may, you may have several providers that get together and want to do something a little more directly.
But I think the bigger question, as I heard it from John, was right now, state does not have any risk with respect to Medicare dollars. And so would we be willing to make a recommendation that the state, when John, whomever, sits down and negotiate, be willing to take on risk in that level? And then
but
the downstream risk is a whole different conversation.
But then you just put out
agree,
your financing.
But actually, I think, John, what I'm also hearing is you're actually – diminishing one element of risk because you have budget certainty. You know dollars will flow.
Right.
By not making some kind of a deal, then you're subject every year to the political shenanigans that go on.
Absolutely.
And the concept that they can cut
right.
you every year.
That's right.
Yeah.
A deal is made for 3 years or 5 years.
Yep.
Then that's diminishing the risk on a sense, in
right.
a sense on the part of the state. Am I wrong?
I agree with that.
No,
at least you're going to know what you have.
Right.
Let me step back from the discussion, from the words for a minute, though, and maybe get to like what is more underlies this, and that is that we all, as a state, spend a lot of money providing services to duly eligible patients. Are they still there? That save Medicare money. So we invest in community-based services that keep people out of the hospital. Invest in other services that keep people out of the emergency room. So what this notion is of the state taking Medicare risk is so that the benefits that accrue from those Medicaid expenditures can be accessed by the state and the healthcare delivery systems within the state. The only current way to do that is through Medicare Advantage plans. In which, I'll just say, it's Patty Pat's the only plan, represents the only plan in the group, but the way the state secure, well, in the dual product, in the integrated product, the way the state realizes Medicaid savings, or Medicare savings, rather, in that context, is we take some of the Medicare savings that the health plan achieves on its Medicare premium. We do that in the context of a PACE program as well. So we assume that the PACE program is going to actually have a surplus on its Medicare premium. And the state, when it sets its Medicaid rate, reduces what it would otherwise pay to capture Medicare savings. When we back up from these words, that's kind of the rationale behind the state wanting to take the Medicare risk. It is the way to access the Medicare savings that we currently aren't able to, any of us, aren't able to really. Can you clarify then if this has been merely the relationship between the state and the state?
Yes, it is the state. We're now, that was the confusion.
So that's the clarification.
Right? So we're now on state-federal relationship.
Right.
Yeah.
We're on state-federal relationship. We're on plan provider relationship, state relationship. The central public question here is what the beneficiaries in Medicare. And I don't want to complicate it, but in a bit of a sense, as soon as you put this out publicly, this does, from the beneficiary, the Medicare beneficiary's point of view, how does any of this affect me as a Medicare beneficiary, although I don't have to. Do you want to address that question, or how do you sense that that's addressed in the conversation? I don't want to make it more complicated, but as we go public with this, that's the gut question.
I think it's very good. But, John, how much money are we talking about, Medicare money for the dual, the state, and suddenly?
Well, I think we had the overlapping slides from last time. It was 41%, I think. I don't have the slide deck.
It's right here. 36.
Yeah, it was $36 billion, both Medicaid and Medicare. Was the overlap. So at roughly 50%, I think, of Medicaid spending.
Yeah, not that guy.
But the thing that's very interesting here is that when we called the CMS Office of the Actuary, we called MedPAC, right, we called Kaiser, we had conversations with everybody who should know, you know, what that concentric ring circle looks like, and people don't have an exact handle on what that means. Right? We took our shot, basically piecing some information together and having a, quote, off-the-record conversation with the CMS actuary to develop, you know, just for purposes that we've highlighted as being draft. But I think the number was 36, and I forgot how much was Medicare, 17?
20.
Was it 17? I think like $17 billion with the Medicare.
Is it really important to have those last words under a capitation arrangement in here? And can you, you know...
How about this? How about we agree today to put a period after population?
Yes.
We ask the state to come back with a more focused analysis of what the Medicare component of this would look like in dollars and potential savings.
Yeah.
But we leave with a bias that the state should do whatever it should to lock in a base on the presumption that health reform is going to work. Otherwise, we've really wasted our time.
Well, the costs that are anticipated in the first...
Well, that has to be negotiated.
Yes, but that's an issue too.
Right. Remember, the Fed said, oh, we're going to save them.
And how about stable financing for the dual eligible population? Doesn't that presuppose
that... Yeah, we could try that. I mean, they're going to have to negotiate that. And the Feds, at the end of the day, are going to say to them, no matter what we agreed to, when we test you later, that you should not have spent more than you would have spent without the waiver. Okay, so that's going to be, right, and that's what they said. So we got to leave some room for negotiating,
but I
think the sense of the bias of the group could reflect. And think about it for a month, but at least agree on the principle. So a recommendation so we can get to number two. Okay.
The only thing I would add at the end there, this is a recent development because I think it touches on the issue of implementation and also I think touches on the issue of, you know, beneficiary protection, is that we thought it was important to have somebody helping us with the rollout of, you know, the waiver. And the commissioner has encouraged us to talk to academics. Dartmouth has, you know, basically indicated they would be interested in working with us. Fisher and those guys said that he would be maybe working with us. So we welcome that. That would, you know, help, you know, make changes along the
shouldn't
way.
Shouldn't that be like kind of a principle that goes up top to everything? I mean, wouldn't we want to have, I think, like the learning, shouldn't we want to have data and, you know, good study of every demo we're doing? And health hosting is a huge demonstration.
Exactly. And I think it's connected. The health home and the dual waiver demo would be connected, and it would allow for flexible learning, all those things. So I think we're touching on a number of things.
The principle
that it should be, we should learn from what we're
doing. That's right. We should evaluate and learn from everything we do.
I think that's parenthetical.
Yeah, we could leave out parenthetical.
Yeah.
Right. Send a quote, but we're not locking in a contract with anybody.
Okay. Where's the dog?
Well, that was easy. Let's do number two.
Sorry, just under the second bullet, I don't know if we want to repeat it again, but I sort of feel like the quality benchmarks are saying to promote patient health and improve patient outcomes. I mean, I just feel like we should just throw in patients a couple more times there.
Yeah. Where are we?
I was just the second bullet under the goals. Create opportunities, you know, that one. Say to, you know, which promote patient health care and improve patient outcomes, or promote patient health and improve patient outcomes.
Thank you.
Just something.
Okay. Ready for number two? So number two is a quality measurement. Develop a series of performance measures for health homes consistent with federal requirements and apply similar measures to the evolving delivery systems such as ACOs, managed long-term care, and BHOs.
So, having struggled with performance measurement at NCQA and NQF for a couple of years now, so this is difficult stuff. And there's a lot of controversy, particularly when you try to link performance measurement to reimbursement. I mean, the atmosphere gets noticeably colder in the room when providers hear that. So, and then the criteria for the robustness and validity, et cetera, of the measures escalates, you know, exponentially when payment is linked. So, I mean, can New York State do this on its own? I mean, I know we're talking about harmonization, but are we really going to develop measures, or are we going to pick, or, you know, from what is being done nationally and what is being required by CMS? Because create the expectation that we have the capacity to actually de novo develop measures, I don't think
it's. We should say adopt rather than develop.
Yeah, exactly.
Adopt. Yeah.
You know, and reference in there that, you know, are consistent with national.
Yeah.
And I think we also want to include the notion that over time, as clinical quality measures become available and useful, that they will be incorporated, not supplant. But I just want to sort of accommodate this notion that the clinical space is slowly coming online.
I still have to get the feedback, though, from our clinical folks, at least on the health film application, that, you know, one of the big concerns is the ease of measurement, and some of the even the ones that you guys have, some of them are redundant to other measures, but some of them aren't, and there's a cost to measuring this stuff, and there's a problem.
And that's
problem.
Part of the tension at the national level, if I'm saying, I mean, that's being worked out.
Simple.
It's huge. I mean, the burden and cost issue, and I mean, we now have over 700 measures, endorsed measures at NQF, and very few of them are the measures that people want, which are outcome measures, you know. And it, let me tell you, that's a big subject within NQF, all, you know, the board and the committees, about how to resolve this tension. And that's why I said, you know, we're not getting near that one.
But shouldn't our recommendations also look at the operational ability to actually produce these measures? I don't see it in the words.
I felt like that was in the guiding principle. Our, you know, so at the bottom of slide one for the guiding principles, it notes that quality measures derived from existing data sets, there's a small nod there, but
I think operational feasibility too needs to be added to that, because it can.
Parent is saying operational feasibility that to the greatest extent possible, the state will promote measures that have the greatest, lowest common denominator. I mean, you know, we get measured on different things by Medicare and by Medicaid, and it's hard when you're working with providers because they have to report on different measures, you know, still. So to the extent that there's overlap,
yeah,
everybody could be working on the same measures to the extent possible. Right. It would make right. Operation.
Well, I mean, all we could do as a state is not have a third measure.
Right.
Right. I mean, we can't. We're not responsible for coordinating what's going on federally. But that's not our role.
It also depends on the type of program. If we're talking about an ACO program for a high-performing provider group,
I expect them to step up and to be able to do a lot on quality measurement and spend money and push the bar. But that's about a specific provider group saying, we want to step up and embrace that, as opposed to system-wide application of quality measures. So, Pat, I feel like there's a place to have to push hard on quality measurement for a small group that's stepping up, as opposed to, you know, payment design across the system where you need to accommodate a lower hurdle.
Would you feel the same way as your small group if you had 10 different quality systems that you had to report on?
I think I could have a lot of complaints about having 10 different quality systems that I have to report on, and I know that the providers I work in my community do manage, even in the ambulatory setting, in 4 or 5 different sets of measures. But I think if they want to step up and do something like an ACO, and that's just an example, I can see where we would need to push on sort of specific outcome quality measures that could not be reflected in some of those data, and that will be costly and time consuming and difficult and take 36 months to get to.
And I think that's admirable. I think I'm thinking about it from the other perspective, because based on the, you know, the health plan, we have to report on QARCIDIS mainly, patient experience of care. And so we use those measures, which are mostly ambulatory, to try to work with the network on what we hope they'll focus on. You know, recording adult BMI, doing X, Y, and Z, those things like that and the other. And what we often hear back is, you know, I've got all these other measures that I'm working on. I can't have to focus on yours. It's too small a slice of my total life, whatever it is. And so I just think that if there is a core measure set that the feds are using, you know, the plans are using, the extent possible to use the same measures, the providers have a clear direction of what they should be working on.
So that's a harmonization issue.
And that's also an adoption issue, adopting someone else's measures. So, yeah.
I would just add a bullet here saying develop a public reporting mechanism to patients and stakeholders and whoever about how the various providers are doing, or DCOs or MLTCs or BHOs, and what bonuses or payments Lulus are received. Like, we want to know how they're doing on the actual performance measures. We also want to know how much they're getting paid because of how they're doing. Because sometimes those aren't the same.
Right.
The people who get the money aren't actually the people who get the money. Like, it'd be nice to know both.
So we want your
other point. You know, when you talk about goals, you don't want to just financially reward high-performance providers, but it was mentioned earlier, we want to talk about rewarding improvement. So that once a threshold is met, people in the fourth quartile should be rewarded for moving into the second quartile and not penalized because they didn't get to the first.
Yeah. You don't want to go crazy on that because then you end up with like all the complaints about the New York City Department of Education.
Good suggestion. Number three is indigent care. Development general principles.
Yep. I'm sorry. Before you do this, I missed our reason for living. I missed last time. I think Elizabeth's study was mentioned, but is everyone aware of the study that CPHS did?
Yes, we are.
Through Professor Sager. There's a lot of data on this topic. I don't know if it was shared with the group.
I think it's attached to your package.
And I think it's on the website. You can get into the details of the current formulas. You'll have that. And you'll
have the
CSS study as well. I don't think the whole – this is what's attached is a very brief synopsis.
Yeah.
There's a lot of data.
Yeah.
But I encourage folks to look at the data before we start crafting recommendations.
The website for the full report here, we actually distributed a lot of respect to the TV. The publication
I'm sorry, John. I saw them.
No, I think that.
Thank you, Molly.
Yeah. No, thank you.
I think we've had, there's a lot of, we did a lot of information on how the formulas work and what's wrong with the formulas and the regulatory, but I think there's a how this affects real people that you will see from looking at both those studies.
Yep.
Which would be my complaint about the recommendations as crafted, because I think if we're looking at Did you want, I'm sorry, did you want to present that?
No, that's fine. I'm happy to kind of give you where I'm going. Well, I think it's all pretty, you know, what we're doing is, you know, develop general principles. And the reason why we thought it was best to take the principles approach is, again, because we don't have the specifics from CMS about where their point stays in terms of allocation methods. And what we found in the past is that, you know, understanding the details is very important when you start making formulaic changes. So that's what we're suggesting up in the potential recommendation. And then, you know, down below, we try to fill in some goals. But with that, I'll stop.
So I think the main point is on any ambiguity that people might have walked away with from last time. I think the committee is, the work group is, or to be unanimous that whatever federal legislation requires, we intend to do the work. Nobody's looking to walk away from that or hedge on that or, you know, deviate from it. There's too much at risk. There's too much money at stake. And I think the first goal underneath there is a way to say quite that bluntly, but we want to ensure New York State does not take more than a share of the reduction, which means we've got to be in compliance. And we've got to figure out what that means.
And timely.
Timely. So be in compliance on time or get whacked.
Right.
Okay. Other thoughts?
I think it's hard to have thoughts without knowing where we're heading. How do we have to, since we don't know what CMS's standards are,
right,
we'll just argue among ourselves. We can't really come to any conclusion.
Well, wait, we know what's in the statute, and we know some very basics. I think what John is getting to a level of detail is how you actually implement that, and I think we could get around principles and recommendations. Same way we don't know any of the stuff on the duals and anything else in that level of detail. But I think there's also, what do we want for our state? And we talked about our general principles in terms of the population and their health. And this is the population, the uninsured, and how they're treated is important, and that they have access to care is important, regardless of the federal cuts. And I think we all agree with that, right, Scott?
No question. I think,
yeah.
Is that the goal we stated here?
I'm not sure I get there. But
number two.
Yeah, fair and equitable approach. It seems very institutionally based, but, you know, I'll leave to others to discuss.
Well, I would just tie it more to, but that's my beef is with number two, actually. So I think that what I don't like about this is that we have the hospital financial assistance law. It says patients have the right to get a financial, you know, that they get to apply for financial aid, that the money is contingent of being provided to hospitals if that they're compliant with this law. We know for a fact, in my opinion, but also based on our work, that many hospitals are not compliant with the face of that law in many areas, and certainly at least their reporting would not indicate that they're compliant. And so the second bullet should tie the allocation of funds directly to the provision of care under the financial assistance law, which we know guarantees care being provided to patients who are uninsured. And then there is the patients who are uninsured for a portion of their insurance, you know, doesn't pay for example, mental health. So, you know, that, and which could get us into dodgy waters with CMS. That bit, the underinsured, let's call them for a second, should be out. But the bad debt piece.
Let me ask you a question. If you were to eliminate in bullet two, underinsured, just call it uninsured, does that get to your point?
No, because it doesn't tie it directly to the financial assistance law. Right now, hospitals put institutional cost reports that say, here are all our costs, but they aren't actually tied to the people necessarily that were applied for financial assistance. So haven't been looked at based on their income eligibility. There hasn't been income adjusted. So
I'm just wondering the level of detail this piece of paper is supposed to get to.
But that's the tail that wags the dog. If you're just throwing the money out to to hospitals based on, you know.
No, I'm not disagreeing. You know that you and I agree on this point.
You know, so I don't understand why you're fighting me on it, Scott.
Say fair and equitable.
I let Marlene talk.
I think it's take it from the perspective. Let's say that this was being written by a group of people who are uninsured and they wanted a system for them. How would they be wording it? They would want the money to go to places that invited them in, that actually gave them access, that treated them well.
And I think that, you know what I mean, that's the kind of thing. It's not necessarily because they suffered the most losses, per se, although that's a piece of it. I guess if, in fact, through your emergency room, you had a lot of uninsured folks, you sent them all to collection agency, you hassled them to take every, you know, their grandchildren's, you know, college fund and all that stuff.
You're downstate, you have 2,000 liens on four people's homes.
Okay, whatever. Versus, and you still have a lot of care, but it's how you're treating the folks that you're taking care of. And there's, do we need to distinguish between those who actually invite people in, treat them respectfully, bescale them in a way that's not threatening and all that good stuff, in conformance with the financial assistance law and also just common decency? I don't know, Art, you want to say something?
No, I mean, I think it's a wonderful thought and a
yeah.
wonderful measure
yeah.
of patient experience. So it's
yeah.
really uninsured. What is the experience of the under and uninsured in the system?
That's
the measure against which you pay, right? That's the metric that you use.
It's the metric we talked about for everybody
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
Why don't we maybe come back with some principles?
Yeah, maybe. We could, at the risk of going out on a limb, we could take a shot at trying to develop principles,
yeah.
if goals under there. But
we'll
we'll read the
yeah.
papers that have been presented.
And of course, preserving the federal dollars is, you know, critical, and we know what's in the statute that said bad debt is a bad thing and high Medicaid is a good thing.
Right.
I think the other thing we mentioned at the last meeting is that we also have to be aware of the Medicare impact here, too, because, you know, there's two sides of this cut that are in play.
Medicare dish, yeah.
Exactly. So I think as part of these principles, we're going to build something in there on the Medicare side.
Absolutely.
Right, okay.
Jim, I just want to look forward to the safety net discussion and just indicate that you're thinking about this. If safety net facilities are defined largely by the inputs of the communities that they're serving, then it is critical as we're thinking about safety net that we achieve something that has the highest performance standards, that at least in aspiration don't differ from the rest of the system. And I think that's a tough issue going forward, but just as we think about getting to the safety net discussion, that's where I would be. Thank you. Okay, we got a lot still on the plate for next time.
And when is next time? We don't know.
We don't know.
So it's not? Okay.
We're setting that up.
We hope that we can disagree.
Well, we
have a date, but we're trying to move to the city, and that might be put the date, so we just want to make sure they can get access to that.
Yeah. So we'll be within the
so
now
why are we skipping the safety net?
Yeah. The last bullet.
Because it's 2:30. I promise to get people to
We've canceled the October 5th. Right, that's been canceled. I just want to make
the tape
quick with that Jewish holiday. So we're going to reschedule a meeting for maybe mid-month. We're trying to make sure everybody's kind of calendars line up, but we know it's going to be.
It's going to be where?
In the city.
Oh, no, the big meeting. Sorry. And the big meeting is on the 6th, 5th, or
The system has detected that a minimum number of lines are connected to this conference. Do you want to continue your meeting? Press 1 to confirm. If there is no response, the conference will end. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.